the glory of lifting the cup in that moment of triumph. His memories kept me enthralled. On the fields of glory. On the fields where boys become men.
And welcome to Coordinated Strike. You're the Other Side podcast, and I have a very special guest tonight. With me is Aaron from Weird Miniatures, the head designer of the Other Side. So welcome to the show, Aaron.
Thanks. How you doing?
Doing well, doing well. How are you, sir?
I'm pretty good.
That's good. Pretty good. So you made a thing.
I did.
And it got funded.
It did do that as well.
And now we're just waiting on it. So I wanted to bring you on the show and kind of talk the other side. And I had a bunch of people on the other place ask some questions as well. So just kind of want to do a quick interview here and get your thoughts on TOS and kind of where it's heading, where it's been, and kind of some of the design philosophy around it, I think, is where a lot of the questions kind of centered. And I know.
Yeah, absolutely. There's only so many questions I'm going to be able to answer about where it's headed, but yeah.
Well, awesome. So one of the first questions we got, and it's near and dear to my heart, is around the structure of kind of organized competitive play. Is that something, first off, that you see the other side being capable of, and something that you guys are going to be embracing in kind of the way that you've created the Gaining Grounds document for Malifaux? Do you see something similar coming for the other side?
Yeah, definitely. I've started working on an organized play document. I want it to be available when we go live with the game. When it's available to players, I want there to also be an organized play document that's robust and everything like that. I think that the other side will serve as a good competitive game. I mean, it's hard to know the balance of a game that people aren't playing, but either way, I think that we've learned enough from Malifaux and everything that, first off, I think the game will be pretty well balanced, and I think that there's so much stuff that you can do, like we did with Malifaux schemes, that, you know, over time, I think that the other side will really, truly come into its own as a competitive game.
I would definitely agree with that as somebody that's, been along for the journey for quite a while on it, so. Very excited for it. Yeah, I definitely think it is something that we will be seeing here soon. Glad to hear that that's something that's coming. And one of the specific questions on that, I don't know how much you can divulge it at this point. Kevin asked, basically, do you see, because of the logistics of tournament play and playing more of an army scale game or company scale game in this case, of kind of going to a fixed list or two fixed list system as opposed to higher at the table? Or is that something you kind of want to leave to TO discretion?
I think that just like in Malifaux, we're pretty open to TOs doing whatever they want to do. I think for the official document, it'll still be list building at the table. Mm-hmm. And I think, frankly, it'll work a lot like Malifaux does. The reality is that in a fixed list environment, you come with whatever you have. When it's not like you come with your entire collection. Usually you say, most people I know who go, they basically have like, well, here's my list and here are the variations I have to meet these various demands. And I think the other side will be the same way, where essentially you could think of it like Magic. You'll probably have your core list and then your sideboard. And based on what you get in the game, you might rotate in one thing, rotate something out, whatever the case would be. But I do think that overall, I'd much prefer that, you know, you build the way the game is played normally, and I don't think it's actually that much of an ask if you're talking about little things. If you're bringing, like, three versions or three copies of every squad for an entire allegiance and everything you can hire in via envoys, like, yeah, it starts to get complex. But I don't know people who go to tournaments like that for Malifaux, which has a similar hiring structure, so.
No, I think that's fair, and I don't know how many people are going to be want to be carrying that many minis around. Obviously, they can if they want to. But I think just from a pure logistics standpoint, it gets a little complex, and I think you're right, people will tend to self-regulate a little more than not.
Yeah. Yeah, it's certainly going to be more models than a skirmish game, but it's less models than someone who's going to play 40K with a fixed list. You could have multiple variations of your army and still have fewer models than many 40K lists. So, I don't think that it is, even logistically difficult. I think it's just more difficult than a skirmish game is.
Oh, absolutely. All right. So let's kind of talk a little bit about, if we can, some of the Fluffwise stuff.
Sure.
David has a question, from a fluff perspective, how broad a look will we get at, Malifaux Earth, i.e. the Earth in the Malifaux setting, which the other side is very present on. It's where the battle is taking place. What regions do you think will receive a more in-depth look in the first book? Anything really you can share fluff-wise he's kind of starving for?
Sure. So basically our stories focus on the areas that our allegiances take up. So you get a pretty good idea of what's happening in England. You get an idea of some of Africa, mostly around Ethiopia, which is where Abyssinia is. And so you get some idea of what's happening there and some of the feeling there. And then you have the gibbering hordes. They are, sort of placeless. I mean, they're oceans and things. They don't have a country,
right,
in any meaningful sense. And then you have the cult, which is also sort of has its rising up story in England. And the general idea is that as future allegiances come out, because we will be doing allegiances in the future, it will focus on other areas. So the world will slowly grow as we look at more and more of these things. It's pretty focused right now because, frankly, writing an alternate history of the world in a book, I'm not sure we'd have space for a game as well.
Oh, definitely. I think that's probably two or three tomes minimum before we see a significant portion of the world kind of light up.
Right. So we're going to handle it a little bit at a time.
I think that's a good way to do it, just to kind of elephant it. Being as we've talked a little bit about England, what countries are included in the King's Empire?
That is a tricky question. Okay. Because of England's sort of place in the world. So the Guild was located in England for a long time, and the Guild had a global reach. So a lot of what people generally identify as part of the British Empire was in the Malifaux universe part of the Guild.
Okay.
So, I mean, if you look at like Sandeep stuff in Malifaux, Sandeep is from India, and India was under Guild control. And so there's some conflation of the British and the Guild because they were in the same place for a long time. But the British have kicked the Guild out. They don't have the Guild's headquarters there anymore. They have separated themselves from the Guild. And so at this point, there's definitely some amount of, figuring things out. So while the British do have some holdings, and I, don't want to get into some sort of list here, most things that you would traditionally associate with them are actually Guild controlled.
Oh, so that's very cool. That's a very neat little twist on our current world situation in terms of,
yeah, so they still have an empire. They're still out there, but
right,
it's not a one for one, because of the Guild. I mean, they've changed things up and they were a colonial power, taking over different parts of the world, and they were doing it from England. So again, there's a conflation and, if you're, from India, you might feel like the British, you might feel like the Guild, you might feel like both. It's not easy to parse like all things in actual history.
Gotcha. So the King's Empire is it's an old idea, but it's kind of got a re-spark with the king, with them throwing the Guild out.
Yes, and that's a pretty recent development.
Okay. No, that makes good sense based on the history as we kind of know it from the RPGs and hints in the Malifaux books themselves about, you know, guild rise to power, black powder wars and such.
Yeah. And you'll also, if you actually check out Through the Breach Second Edition, which is in stores now, you'll also see there is some stuff about Earth on there. And you know, that's sort of all coming from the same sort of, place with the other side. So you'll see things that matter for Malifaux and you'll see things that matter for the other side.
Very cool. All right, so Neil, that was Neil Brown's question. He also had another one. What it was the most fun model, asset, or stratagem to design?
I definitely enjoyed making the artillery team because it was a very interesting piece, and it actually started as a guy. It wasn't an artillery team. He originally had a name, and then he became generic over time. But it was just sort of fun to think, like, how artillery would work in the game. So I definitely had fun with that. But at the end of the day, I think the most fun things to design were all in that same category. So the Devouring Eel, the Immolated Rhino, were probably two of my favorites, and the Marauder is up there too. And some of that is because they actually got designed last, which means that I was the most comfortable and the rules were the most settled. So it was a little more like legitimate, just fun, like, oh, how can I mess with these rules? And some of that is because they didn't need to follow any actual structure, meaning like there was a lot of free reign. I wasn't like, oh, this has to be a squad. I could just say, like, what would be really cool here? And so I got to do some really unique stuff and try to think of how, you know, you can make something that essentially doesn't have wounds survive and be impactful on the battlefield in a meaningful way.
Yeah, there's some really clever bits in there, if I do say so. And it's very neat to see that those were kind of designed last, and sort of, you can kind of tell if you really look at some of the rules on the units, you could probably guess pretty accurately what was something early and what was something late.
Sure. I mean, it makes sense. And, you know, we started with a lot of stuff in the King's Empire. And a lot of that is because, they have a lot going on and they're really interesting. So I certainly don't mean this in any negative way, but they are a very good baseline to use for the game. You know, they shoot well. They move, but they're like, cult is not a place to really start with your rules because of the weird teleporty stuff. It's hard to get a grasp on, like, are these core mechanics working? So you really want to start with things that obey the general rules and do neat stuff in them. So it all started from there. And I think that gave, King's Empire a lot of, like, really solid numbers and a really good place to build off of. And then we just got to add some cool, flavor into that and some things outside the realm of just killing everything.
Totally. Now this is just kind of one of my questions, is the other side really shows a very kind of unique design philosophy. Do you mind kind of talking a little bit about your approach to the game in terms of the design philosophy and kind of from a general rules and design perspective, kind of the guide rails and restrictions you kind of put on yourself to sort of shape the game to what it is, which I think is a really great place and really great game, if that question makes sense.
Yeah, sure. So, from very, very early on, we had a few things that we wanted to hit, and those came from different places, within the company. Some are mine, some are other people's. But essentially, we knew we wanted to have this, sort of larger game, and we knew we wanted to minimize tracking, and allow players to just sort of play the game without that much thinking. And then, you know, for myself, I definitely was on board with the minimized tracking. And I also really just wanted a larger game that didn't necessarily require a million models, that still felt like a larger game and that was, I'm going to say, easy to demo. And that sounds a little strange, I think. But at the same time, I've been demoing miniatures games essentially since I started playing them. So for quite a long time now. And there are always some struggles that you face with new players, particularly people who come in from outside of miniatures games in general. And there's just stuff that, like, I just really wanted to be able to get past. And, you know, basically, you know, when I say I or we, you know, it's weird stuff. So, like, mm-hmm. some of it might be actually me and some of it is more of like a royal I. But anyway, the point just being that, you know, we really ended up focusing down, on these different things, and like pre-assembled miniatures, is just trying to remove barriers to entry to players, was a big deal to me. And trying to remove barriers to gameplay so that nobody felt like they needed to know everything to have a good chance at winning. And obviously when you get in more and more competitive play, the more you know, it's going to matter. But, you know, basically I wanted people to be able to show up, open their box, play, not have to read 20,000 rules. So, you know, that's why you play with one side of the card at a time. I didn't want you to be using both sides of the card. I wanted everything to be, simple. And I use simple, in the positive way. Mm-hmm. and really just let players get into, the decision making processes as opposed to drown them in the what decisions are there to make. So simplify the decisions themselves so the decision making process is hard.
No, that makes total sense. I often describe the game as a lot of very simple systems that require a lot of very hard decisions.
Yeah, I think that, you know, like keeping the model count low, reinforcement has a lot to do with that. And, you know, the ability to bring models back into play. And, you know, as you mess with a system like reinforcement to try to make everything work, everything in the game is a holistic part of the game itself. So everything informs everything else. And, you know, you make little changes and it can have far reaching impacts. And as I went through the rules, for years, and messed with things, you end up getting into these places with the rules where I'm going to say that you start to try to write the rules in a very, everything is permissible way. And so instead of saying like rush, the rush order is a great example. You know, you start with this traditional idea of charge in miniatures games, which is like, move in a straight line at these people and do this. And, you know, and you get all these sort of specific, like, you need to be able to see them. You need to end up this close. I roll a die to get here. You do this, you do that. And I just wanted to say, like, look, like, move twice your speed and then maybe you attack at the end. Like, that's up to you. And instead of getting a very prescribed, sort of deductive process, I really wanted to focus on sort of, I'm going to say, inductive thinking as you play the game. Mm-hmm. So, and really, you know, if a player thinks they should be able to do something, how can I let them do that? And I think that just removes so many barriers, because then as a player, instead of thinking like, how can I exploit this rule? You think, how can I outsmart my opponent? And obviously there's always going to be some sort of like rules, like how can I get the most out of this rule or whatever. But I really wanted to focus the gameplay. Like I want the player to win, who wins, to think like, I made better decisions this game, not, wasn't it cool that my opponent didn't know I could do this?
No, totally. But in playing this, it's definitely been, I can track the moment in the game when I made the incorrect choice, an incorrect decision that ultimately led to my opponent eventually getting the advantage and winning. And that to me is really powerful in a game because I can learn from my mistakes a lot easier because my mistakes are more apparent on the relook.
Right. Right. Yeah. I remember writing articles about playing games, for my blog back when I had a blog, just said, you know, one of the things, if you can't figure out how you're losing a game, you have to change the way you play that game, you know, play faster or whatever so you can see more cause and effect relationships. And I do think the other side, it is just easier to see cause and effect relationships of like, oh, that's where that went south. Or, man, I took that inspired token there to get that hit, but I really just should have taken the reinforcement token. There are enough variables to provide differences, but not so many that you cannot keep track of it in your head.
Yes. That's excellently spoken. One of the things that has kind of really drawn Adrian Scott to the game has been the fire team concept, or the concept of several models on a base representing part of a unit in the game, or being a unit in the game, and sort of the opportunities that brings from a modeling perspective. Can you kind of go into the genesis of that, or kind of how that became a mechanic? Because I think it's sold a lot of people on the game, and I think it's really going to be cool to see what people do with essentially a multi-basing technique on it, because that's kind of a key feature of the game.
Yeah. You know, the bases, in some ways, I feel like they are the foundation the game is built on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because it was a Malifaux game, we know we wanted to use cards, and, you know, cards provide some amazing things, and they have some limitations. And then because we knew we wanted more models, you know, more models can provide some awesome scenes, but they also have limitations. And the bases are frankly just the answer to two issues. And, you know, it seems weird to talk about them like that, but they give so much to the game. And, you know, as a game designer, I get into these different thought processes. And, you know, everything's informing everything else. And there are certain times that there's a mechanic or idea or whatever that essentially you can just use in so many ways that, you know, maybe it solved one issue and then you realize it's, you know what, it's actually solving like four more things or allowing me to do these different things. And I feel like the bases are that. I'd say the biggest place that they have their genesis is really in speeding up gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
If I only have to move three things instead of nine things, it's just faster. I don't have to measure as much. I don't have to randomize as much. It just speeds up gameplay. And then, you know, it also, based on my understanding of these things, which is albeit limited, it's also more similar to how things actually function. Like, it's not, if you think of a military unit as a collection of individuals, that is true, but generally speaking, they are attacking the same targets and things like that. And, you know, people work together and everything like that. And I did some research into sort of military structure, and that's why they're named fire teams, because fire teams are collections of like 2 to 3 people, who work together. And then, you know, you go up from there to squads and things like that. And that's where it comes from in the game. And the idea that like, look, if you have 9 guys, sometimes they're not all going to shoot it at the same person. So the fire teams let me accomplish that, all at the same time, not saying like, well, now they're going to get 9 shots at different people. And so, yeah, it's just so many things that it's hard to say like it specifically arose out of X, but there are things I can point to so many places where I could say it arose out of that. But the reality is, you know, It is just so fundamental to the other side that it arose out of the game, and the game arose out of it. Like it's a bedrock.
Yeah, it's definitely a foundational piece of the game. I mean, I can't imagine working in an environment in terms of the other side where we didn't have the fire team. Like, is it it's the ideas of groupings of models that work together and execute almost as one, execute as one unit that they can then be slotted into, you know, squads or combined arms. It's just,
yeah,
it's totally key and fundamental. And then you go even further where it allows you to rapidly move, rapidly reinforce, you get the idea of this scale without having to have people have, you know, 50, 60, 70 of the same miniature just to represent a giant unit. You could do that with nine guys on three bases that can bring people back.
Right. I remember, so we announced the game at Gen Con 2 years ago, maybe? I don't know. We announced it a while back, and I was having a conversation with George, and if any of you have ever been Gen Con volunteers with us, you probably know George. But I was having a conversation with George after Gen Con ended about the game, and he was saying to me, because he has been involved with the armed services, that it always bothers him when, like, these guys all stand clumped up when, like, the enemy's throwing grenades. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's not how people react. And, you know, just talking about, like, how to deal with essentially templates in a game like this. And, you know, just from the very beginning, like, the idea that sometimes people split up is really important. And, you know, I remember seeing your post on The Other Place, Joe, about, you know, when dealing with area weapons, you know, spread out. And, like, yep. And, you know, I'm sure some people are going to say, like, well, that's ridiculous. Like, you can just avoid area by staying far enough apart. And, like, the answer is, like, yeah, like, that's how life works. Like, if people are doing explosives, like, just spread out and you'll minimize the damage. There are weaknesses for spreading out. You know, people can collapse on you and stuff, but that's how you minimize the effects of certain types of things. And again, the fire team bases just play into that. Like, I can let my squad spread out a bit more without really losing cohesion than, you know, a shorter distances. I can get up to 8 inches because they have these cohesive bases that always make them seem like a cohesive force on the table.
Very good. Very cool. Yeah, it's a very cool design, core mechanic. The other bit is Glory itself, and I think Glory is a system that is super unique in that in so many games they try and do a psychology system where it's about failure is bad, and you never see the other side of it, which is you're in the heat of battle, and all of a sudden this guy decides he wants to live, and to do that, he's going to go all the way to the wall, take that hill, and he's going to inspire everybody around him. And that really is kind of the idea so far with Glory, is that your guys get better because they're in it now, and they've got to go. They've got to move forward and do what they need to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Glory, I didn't feel like we could have an army game without a morale mechanic. I felt like, you know, that's one of the fundamental differences between skirmish and army is this morale thing. And so I really wanted a morale mechanic in there, and everything I threw at the wall for a negative mechanic just didn't work, because essentially it's either so bad that you can't ever let it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Like an entire squad just routing because they lost one guy. Like, you just can't let that happen. The balance is too swingy on that. Or it's really not that bad at all, and do you really even need it at that point? And we tried a few different things for morale going into it, but then eventually it was just like, you know, we can have morale in a different way. We can flop this whole thing on its head, and instead let these characters be better. And that allowed us to still have morale, still address things from that standpoint, but instead of you getting beaten down and as the game drags on, everybody gets worse and worse and worse, we can say, like, no, like, people aren't getting worse and worse. I mean, they do because you take damage and can no longer cheat flips, or you lose actions because fire teams are dead or whatever. But you also have this other mechanic that says, you know, you're capable of getting better as well, and that, you know, there are times that people surge to glory. And it's just a nice juxtaposition because There is an amount of attrition gain that will always be there, but I didn't think we needed a morale attrition on top of a troop attrition. I'm really happy with the way Glory works out as a positive, because you can do a lot more with a positive mechanic than you can with a negative one.
No, excellent. That's totally. It's to me, it was one of the huge selling points of the game, is that you could change an entire unit simply by changing what's on its card on the other side, and because when you're flipping it over, you're just taking the exact baseline of what is on the new side of the card. So I mean, you could take, you know, a person and very easily turn it into a giant monster. Or, you know, you could have your army guys become a little bit better. Maybe get some access to some new abilities. And
yeah.
Glory, as a base mechanic of, you can change your units seamlessly in the game, and then you tie it into a morale effect, and then it also allows you to, I mean, you've gone and taken it and you've used it to diversify the armies and give them their own flavor. Like, Gibbering Hordes, it's all about evolution and survival, and so they literally eat the weaker members of their species to get stronger. With the Cult of the Burning Man, it's about embracing of insanity. So they want some of the worst tokens on the game on their units so that they can get better. With Abyssinia, it's about being better than your opponent to a point where you actually have this giant eureka moment. You have this giant surge of, you know, in game terms, it's just a margin of six. But, you know, thematically, it's, I'm doing this way better than you are, and we're going to use that to beat you. And so I think all those things are, it's a really cool core mechanic that is the morale system for the game, but it's so much more when you really look at what's kind of been tacked on to it, in terms of where you're getting some flavor, getting some army differentiation, and just, you know, and to me, that's just very clean, good, elegant design.
Well, thank you.
All right. Adrian had one more. We've kind of talked a little bit that Beings Australia is part of Old King's Empire. It would be under guild control, so that's where that's at, more than likely.
Yeah, I think, and I don't have a great memory, but I think Australia might have remained King's Empire.
Okay.
But I'd have to double check, and I can't really do that from home.
No worries. This strange person here, Kai, Hall, wants to know what main difference was in designing for the other side versus designing for other games you've worked on.
I did better on this one. it depends on which other game. I mean, it varies so much. I think that the big difference versus designing for something like Malifaux is that you need to get the core idea of a model or a unit, in the case of the other side, down in essentially half a card. If you can't accomplish it in half a card, you're doing it wrong. And that is just not the case in Malifaux. And then the allegiance cards matter so much in the other side. They change the way that you write rules. You have theme automatically, and then you just need to add flavor. So you know, like the King's Empire bayonet's ability allows them to use their guns in melee. Mm-hmm. And that meant I didn't have to waste any space on their cards on melee attacks. Now, some of them obviously have them, but I didn't have to do it without feeling like I was sort of neutering the entire force. So, you know, you just have to think so differently about the other side, the Malifaux, because you're no longer thinking about, you know, ways you can play with these complex interactions, Instead, you're thinking about ways you can utilize, you know, your allegiance card and this little bit of card space and the rules that exist to maximize what that unit's doing on the table. And then, like, how can Glory interpret that? How, you know, is this a model that they're going to want to glory right away, or is it a model that they don't care if they glory? So, you know, that's the comparison there. It's much harder to compare to anything that's not a miniatures game.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, I would say that, you know, when you look at something like writing rules for Malifaux, writing rules for the other side, and writing rules for a board game, in some ways, I think it's a little closer to writing rules for a board game,
mm-hmm.
In the sense that you are, the system is less complex than something like Malifaux. So, like I had said earlier, I really tried to focus on, like, letting players do what they think they should be allowed to do based off what they're seeing of what's in front of them. And so, it's hard to say, but at the end of the day, I feel like it is tight in a way that, lets you essentially explore inside the mechanics more easily. And that, I feel like it's a little bit closer to a board game that way, but it's really hard to compare to anything that's not a miniatures game, because miniatures games are just sort of so distinct. But, you know, we draw from different places. I mean, there are the stratagems and everything that tried to incorporate some card mechanics. And I remember playtesters talking about, like, the general mechanics of card hands and what things should cost versus, like, you know, momentum and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so that was all interesting. The easiest comparison is Malifaux. And it's just a very different way of thinking about the model / unit.
No, it makes total sense. The way I kind of look at it and kind of how it's pretty clear to me as somebody that plays both systems, Malifaux is very much the microscopic view of an individual, and so it's all about making that individual seem epic and grand. And the other side is all about taking the camera to the wide-angle view of the battle and making the force that you're playing, the allegiance that you're playing, epic and grand, but the individual guys are sort of a set of neat mechanics with some fluff, but the things that they can do in unison and how that allegiance functions as a whole is where you get the real flavor and tactical intricacies, where in a skirmish game, you want every single model, because you don't have many of them, to be really engaging and really tactically deep. And in more of a company size game, you want the units and the interplay between the units to be what's driving the game. And so it gives you a little more freedom to be a little more vague, if that kind of makes sense.
And I think you get to, you know, stereotype essentially. Instead of, like, I can say, like, you know, I'm Aaron, and then you go out to, like, I'm in Cobb County, and then you go out to, like, I'm Georgian, and then you go out to, you know, I'm part of the United States. And the army scale goes into that, and, like, how much am I actually, you know, a stereotype of any of those individual groups? You know, probably not super much, but you're still, you know, within that confine. So, you know, as Joe was saying, like, you're looking at it at a different scale. It doesn't matter how much, what that one guy in your squad can do. It matters what the squad does. And when you're worrying about what the squad does, you're worrying about how it functions on the battlefield and how it relates to other squads. You're not worried about how the individual people relate to one another, and what their individual capabilities are. You know, if Joe and I were on the same fire team, Joe might be a better shot than me. But does it really matter? It matters how much we hit overall.
Right. It's the volume of fire coming out of that individual represented as a single flip in terms of the fire team unit. The three guys right on it are representative of some volume of fire.
Right, because for the most part in the game, you're going to be able to do 3 damage in a blow. There are rare times that you're going to do more, you're going to be able to actually do more than that. Three damage is sort of your max out, and it'll wipe out people, and that can come from a single attack flip, but that's because that attack flip is coming from a bunch of guys, or maybe it's just coming from a single person, but who took multiple shots. You know, this isn't, you know, muskets when reloading. Like, people can take multiple shots, and, you know, the timeline of it, narratively is fluid, because, you know, obviously real life doesn't go in turns.
Right.
I'd probably be better at it if it did.
Oh, totally. Alright, so Roger's got a few last questions here. Kind of, what was the decision behind making the control hand a resource where you're buying your control hand out of the tactics tokens?
Frankly, it just made sense to me. So, if the game has resource management, which it does, and I thought it should, if the game has that, I think it's much better if you essentially just have one resource. I think that mechanically it's more powerful to have one resource. Now, you're going to have effects in the game that require card discards, and you're going to have effects in the game that require tactics tokens. So it does branch off, but having them be one cohesive whole means that you are essentially thinking about one resource the entire game. And again, it's down to that, you know, reducing decision points while increasing how you can interact within those decisions. So, by making it just tactics tokens, like, now you have to decide, do I want stratagems? Do I want reflips? Do I want to interact with objective markers? Do I want to draw cards? And the reality is that, like I said, it just made sense to me because, it's a limit on what you can accomplish in a turn. And if cards had just been drawn, you just don't value them as much. If that makes sense. It just doesn't tie in the same way. It's not as meaningful to you. And, if I give you cards and then make you have discard effects, like you're like, oh, I'll just discard these low cards. Every card you draw in the other side is powerful because it's a tactics token. And because there's no card draw naturally as well, like if you draw two into your hand, you just keep it basically forever. I mean, there are times you might get rid of it for card discard effects or because you went over your max hand size, but it sits there. Like, you paid for that, and you're not going to have to deal with that too unless you do something about it. Where Malifaux is much more cyclical, and, you know, you're discarding and drawing back up. And again, that makes more sense where you're talking about an individual people who, you know, have these moments of defying fate and everything like that. But when you're talking about a group of individuals, it creates a nice thing to essentially have it there. And then, on top of that, it means that the game ends up being a bit more random because you can't really use all of your tactics tokens on cards successfully. I mean, I'm sure some people will, but, that means that you not only value your cards more, but you are going to think about a lot of things in the game differently because of it. And it made a lot of sense to me to say, oh yeah, why am I just giving you resources every turn? I'll make you pay for them. And yes, I give you the tactics tokens. I mean, it's just a different point, but, because tactics tokens branch off into five different things and, you know, you could do it with cards. It just felt, I'm going to say more primal to me to make it the tactics tokens.
I think it was a great decision. Kind of, to me, it kind of shows some of your board game chops with utilizing the tactics tokens as the primary resource in the game. Because the tactics tokens are used to generate your hand, which generates an additional resource in board game turns. Additionally, it's used to score you victory points because you typically cannot score without spending tactics tokens outside of killing an enemy commander, which, again, doesn't end the game. So you're going to be spending those on some type of objective mechanic. You're also spending those to facilitate coordinated strike where you're getting a little bit of boost in ability. So there's a lot of points to put your resources, and because of that, your resources are very strained, which is good.
Yeah. Yeah. You just do end up feeling differently about it as you play the game, and hopefully everybody experiences that, that, you know, you're always going to feel pressed on them in a way that is going to challenge you. And although they do refresh, because you use them for essentially other effects. Where cards, generally, when you draw a card, it's going to be used to cheat a flip. When you get a tactics token, there's like, oh, which of the five things am I going to use this for?
Yep. And it makes it so difficult to even, like, there's some games I have considered not drawing cards because the options from the tactics tokens just prove sometimes to be more useful depending on the opponent.
Yeah, they let you get past the Black Joker.
Yes, which is hugely powerful. And as somebody where, you know, bad things happen is the tagline at Malifaux. Toss should be, you have total control.
Yeah, I've been asked about that tagline before. Unfortunately, I don't think I ever came up with an amazing one. I feel like it should have something to do with glory, personally. But I never know.
I would definitely, the marketing person in me would say yes, definitely something with glory.
Yeah.
All right, so if you can touch on anything of kind of the future of TOS, which I believe is very bright, if you have any window into what's coming down the road, if you can share that, I'm sure people would appreciate that, or whatever you could share on that from that effect.
Yeah, I mean, we're playtesting stuff still. We stopped very, very briefly, but we've jumped back into some more playtesting, very early playtesting, but playtesting nevertheless. And I can say that I have, I'm going to say 2 years pretty solidly defined and 3 years, you know, an additional year on top of those 2 years in a loose sense. And then I've got scribbled notes for things potentially past that. I want to expand allegiances, in terms of the number of allegiances in the game. I think that having different allegiances is a good way to go. So I don't intend, but, you know, things change, to go super deep into allegiances. So that, you know, next year isn't going to see Abyssinia doubling in size. Instead, it's going to see, you know, another allegiance or some such thing. And I don't know exactly timelines. Those are just examples. But, yeah, the idea is to hopefully expand the game out allegiance-wise, giving new allegiances, and using Envoy rules to essentially augment what people are capable of bringing in lists without continuously significantly augmenting their allegiance directly. So, will Abyssinia get new stuff in the future? Yes. But I don't expect it to be, you know, like seven things a year. It's much more likely to be, you know, a couple things a year. I don't know. It's hard to say for sure. Instead, you're much more likely to see another dual faction commander somewhere down the line that lets you hire from one of these other new allegiances. And now Abyssinia, you know, you're like, okay, I can take from Guild, I can take from King's Empire, and now I can take from this other thing too. And now your options have expanded pretty broadly. And the commanders can really change play styles up. And getting in a different, an envoy card and everything like that. But it didn't mean that suddenly your faction, allegiance has that much more stuff going on. So it's a different type of trying to release, and appeal to all these different groups without complicating any individual allegiance, so that even, you know, 10 years from now, when the other side is considered the king of games, there's still going to be like, oh, what's Abyssinia got? Well, that's actually pretty easy to explain. I don't have to talk about 100 different things Abyssinia has. I can talk about, you know, the 15 things Abyssinia has, and then their ability to take from a variety of other places.
No, and it makes total sense also from the kind of thematics of the game that they're going to go into these regions and the Earthside forces are probably going to help each other because they're fighting a common enemy, even though they may also be fighting amongst themselves.
Yeah, they definitely don't like each other very much.
No.
But that doesn't mean that they won't work together from time to time.
Right, because we all know the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the envoy thing came together late. Mm-hmm. We always had the dual commander thing where they could hire from a couple. But the ways envoys end up working out came together late in the process. And I'm going to say thrilled with it. It's one of my favorite things, because it gets all the sort of, multi-hiring rules out of the core rules and onto these cards.
Yep.
And then it also got, it fixed up so many issues with like, but cult can't teleport. And stuff like that. It allowed to bring in these other allegiance cards and to provide different things. And if you look at, you know, an envoy from the guild, one of the syndicates, is actually very different than an envoy from, say, King's Empire. So if you are Abyssinia, taking an envoy from the guild is different than taking an envoy from the King's Empire, which means that you're going to get different things out of it. And not just because of the, you know, abilities that are different between the Guild and the King's Empire, but also because of the hiring restrictions. So I can change how you hire out of your allegiance on every single card. And, you know, obviously they're going to obey a core structure and functionality, mm-hmm. but it just gives so much more flexibility. If one day in the future I want to do a dual person who's, you know, King's Empire and Cult of the Burning Man, that's possible, because envoys can make it happen in a meaningful way.
Exactly. And again, it's another simple system that allows some complex decisions and opens up list building, eases design, and makes your design space and design decision ability so wide open, because you can have basically anything work with anything. And again, so if you've got an awesome story about, you know, cultist stealing or getting in bed with Abyssinia, you know, now you have a way to represent that on the tabletop, which is pretty cool. If need be, and as design allows and time allows, if it makes sense, you can do something like that. And that is, you know, that's one of the things I'm so hyped on the other side for. Obviously, I've made a podcast for it, dedicated to it. Love the game, love the system, is that it is such a rewarding game to play, rewarding game to think about, but it's not a difficult game to play. It's very easy to get started. And I hope that everyone listening and, we're definitely very appreciative for Aaron and his time. And if you just want to kind of give your final thoughts on the other side and why people should pick it up, try it out, and anything else you want to plug, please feel free.
Sure. I think I already plugged Through the Breach a little bit there. So thanks for having me. It's nice to talk about. I am so excited for the game to come out. It's really been awesome because I've only gotten more and more excited about the game from the beginning. So, you know, I'm more excited now than I was 3 months ago and so forth and so on. And that's just really exciting to know that, you know, I'm pumped for this game. I feel more strongly about it. And, you know, there's always, you know, those questions of, you know, of design questions. But, you know, I just see, playtesters, who are just excited to see the game come out and seeing it and everything. And, you know, I think it's like, the cold feet jitters, and I'm pumped for the game. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, if you're thinking about picking it up, or you're thinking about talking to your friend about picking it up, or, you know, you got it and you're hoping that it scratches an itch for you, all I can say really to you is that it is a remarkably easy game to teach. I have demoed it so many times. It teaches easily. If someone buys it, if they buy an Allegiance box, it comes with the deck, the tokens, a measuring tape, the models, and the models are assembled. When you buy something for this game, you can take it out of its box and start using it immediately. And when you buy an Allegiance box, it has everything you need to play, with the exception of the rules, which will be free online and, you know, not a problem there. So, you get your friend together, you buy some boxes, you can play, you want to pick something up, you buy it, you open it, you put it on the table, and it's not that difficult for your opponent either. So, you know, even if other people have been playing the game for 2 years and someone else is jumping in, they're not going to be significantly behind. They might not know, you know, the high level strategies, but the high level strategies are not high level strategies because, you know, you've gone through this complex web of rules. They're high level strategies because you understand how the interactions of the tabletop play out, and, you know, target priority and things like that. So I think all that adds in. And then in terms of, you know, why play the other side versus other games? It's fast, it's intuitive, and it is competitive. I think that people will find that, you know, when you play the game, you will naturally be drawn to these sorts of cinematic moments, because we really wanted to create these cinematic moments that, you know, you have these exciting things happening, but they are still controlled by strategic, tactical, whatever you want to call it, decisions. And yeah, I just think that it's a game that's going to grow over time, because you can play it at tournaments and you can play it incredibly casually. It doesn't require a gigantic investment, and you can start playing right away. It just, yeah, I really wanted to address a lot of the sort of barriers that I saw in miniatures games. And, you know, that meant time to play a full game, and it meant, you know, you have to assemble the models and all that. And, you know, my hope is that the other side breaks down the barriers for miniatures games so that it's really open to a wide audience, and you can play it in addition to your other game. If you really love some other miniatures game, like, it doesn't require you to play it and exclusively it to understand how to play the game. So, you know, it could be your second game, it could be your primary game, it could be your third game. It doesn't really matter, because it just, you know, lets you play it and enjoy it without having to wonder about, you know, weird rules interactions or not knowing what your opponent's models do. You can look at the card, see they've got one attack action, you're good to go.
Perfect. Well, again, I thank you so much for being on, Aaron, and representing Weird and talking about my new favorite game, The Other Side, and for all your work on the other great Weird games, including North American Snake Monster.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
All right. Again, appreciate it, and we look forward to seeing how The Other Side develops, and I look forward to seeing you across on the Fields of Glory, Aaron, as we play The Other Side.
Great.
And that has been a coordinated strike. Remember, if you've got a tactics token, you can make a coordinated strike.